take just a couple of minutes and recap where we are in Isaiah. We've kind of covered a lot of material. And if you, this is in your notebook or should be in your notebook. If you ever get lost, you can go right back to that. You might need a magnifying glass to look at it. But so we're in the part that some writers call the Book of Kings, the Book of the King, I'm sorry, six, which is chapters like 6 through 37. And the other two books are about the conqueror and the servant. But we have first in 1 through 12, judgment and hope for Israel. And that was 1 and 5 was threat of judgment, and 6 through 12 was the promise of rescue through the Emmanuel figure. Then 13 through 27 was the judgment and hope for the nations, so the Gentile world. And 13 through 23 was the fall of Babylon and the other neighbors of Israel. And then 24 through 27 is often called the Tale of Two Cities. So that just kind of gives you a snapshot of where we are. One theologian says this unit is probably the least read and preached section of the whole book of Isaiah, but it is essential to understanding his prophecy. And last week, Carol Ann covered chapter 22 and talked about the Valley of Vision. When Jerusalem was under threat, they chose the road of self-sufficiency and were judged for it. Instead of trusting God to protect them, which they should have done, they trusted in themselves and allied themselves with other nations. And aren't we often like that? We turn to our own resources first instead of God and his resources. Well, this week, I want to talk briefly about the structure of this whole section from 13 to 27. And then I want to concentrate on 25 through 27, the marshmallow. Chapters 13 through 23 was a set of 10 oracles. They are not chronological. And each of those had five parts. It sounds a little complicated, but it's not. And so just kind of don't worry. You know, just know that there's a structure, that each one had five parts. Chapters 13 through 20 was when Isaiah reviewed the world around him and pronounced oracles concerning specific nations, Babylon, Egypt, Tyre. And they were actual enemies of Israel. And then in 21 through 23, the nations are named. They're given names, but the names are really more cryptic, with the emphasis being more on the principle that the nation represented. For instance, Babylon represented a symbol of evil and rebellion against God and his people, which actually goes back to the Tower of Babel and continues right on through Revelation. And Babel can also symbolize the sinful rebellion of God's own people. And fun fact that I didn't realize till doing some of this studying was that the first city was formed by Cain when he left and he needed protection. He was worried that the people of God would kill him. So in the beginning, cities really were not to be heralded. They were not a good thing. All right, then you have the third cycle. There were three cycles. Chapters 24 through 27 make the third cycle. And it's not broken up into individual oracles. It is a continuous whole. And Isaiah, he offers no headings here, but gazes straight forward to the end times. Those are the three divisions of chapters. And within these three divisions, there are always five themes. First is the human attempt to organize the world into a global village, like at the Tower of Babel. The second is Zion's future is secure because after many days, the Lord will reign in glory in Zion. The third is the world's needs can only be met in David's rule. Number four would be the people of God enjoy true security and peace in the strong city of salvation. And the fifth one is called the final gathering. One world, one people, one God. And in chapters 24 to 27, we come to the climax of God's message of judgment and salvation for the whole world. The wicked will be condemned, and God's people are going to be lavishly blessed. And sometimes these four chapters are referred to as a mini-apocalypse, or they're eschatological in nature because of the imagery used to depict God's final victory. And try to say apocalyptic and eschatological real fast. We begin chapter 24 as it looks beyond the current history of Isaiah to the end of the world as we know it. We see a picture of the whole earth under God's judgment, and it's in very graphic terms. If we look at the first six verses of Isaiah 24, Behold, the Lord will empty the earth and make it desolate, and he will twist its surface and scatter its inhabitants. And it shall be as with the people, so with the priest, as with the slave, so with his master, and as with the maid, so with her mistress, with the buyer, so with the seller, as with the lender, so with the borrower, as with the creditor, so with the debtor. The earth shall be utterly empty and utterly plundered, for the Lord has spoken his word. The earth mourns and withers, the world languishes and withers. The highest people of the earth languish. The earth lies defiled under its inhabitants, for they have transgressed the laws, violated the statutes, and broken the everlasting covenant. Therefore, a curse devours the earth, and its inhabitants suffer for their guilt. Therefore, the inhabitants of the earth are scorched, and few men are left. The earth will be completely laid waste and totally plundered, for the Lord has spoken his word. And those are there's all that in that first six verses. Notice particularly verse 5 gives the reason for this destruction. The earth's been defiled by its people. So one writer said that really the biggest environmental threat on the earth is the people. And it's a cosmic event. The city's left in ruins. The wine is dried up. Party's over. The covenant is broken. The whole chapter is spent pretty much describing this final destruction, except for a very small section beginning in verse 13. For thus it shall be in the midst of the earth among the nations, as when an olive tree is beaten, as at the gleaning when the grape harvest is done, they lift up their voices, they sing for joy. Over the majesty of the Lord, they shout from the west. Therefore in the east, give glory to the Lord. In the coastlands of the sea, give glory to the name of the Lord, the God of Israel. From the ends of the earth, we hear songs of praise, of glory to the righteous one. It's a description of the gleanings of the harvest, or the remnant of God's people. A little withered grape here and there, an olive that someone missed, that's it. But then a funny thing happens in the midst of all this gloom. They raise their voice in song, proclaiming the Lord's majesty. You see, the people of God sing amidst their trials, showing their faith. It's a small picture of what is to come, and it shows us how God plans world history around his people, the remnant. And then the chapter ends with verse 23. The moon shall be confounded and the sun ashamed, for the Lord of hosts reigns on Mount Zion and in Jerusalem. He reigns on Mount Zion and in Jerusalem, and his glory will be before his elders. That verse would have reminded the people in Isaiah of a passage from Exodus 24, just before Moses received the Ten Commandments. It says, Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel went up, and they saw the God of Israel. There was under his feet, as it were, a pavement of sapphire stone, like very heaven for clearness. And he did not lay his hand on the chief men of the people of Israel. They beheld God and ate and drank. So that was like, 75 people who actually had dinner with God back in Exodus. And I had forgotten about that verse. You think you get so caught up in Moses and the Ten Commandments and all that that you forget they had this big feast before that, and the only thing they could see of God was his feet, but it was still a feast for the Lord, and his glory was with them. So this is a picture of God reigning on Mount Zion, and it sets the scene for the next three chapters. When my dad was still living, and we were celebrating his birthday, it was like, I don't know, his mid-80s, we were up in Oxford eating lunch, and my sister was saying, oh, Daddy, I can't wait, you know, till next year when we have your birthday and all. And my daddy looked straight at her and he said, oh, no, this might be my last one. This might be my last birthday. I might catch the train to glory. Well, of course, my sister, no, Daddy, you know. But her daughter, my niece, is a singer-songwriter. And so she wrote a song in honor of that moment. She wasn't even there. But anyway, and it's really funny because we sung it at both my father's funeral and my mother's funeral, but it's called A Train That's Bound for Glory. And the two of the verses say, well, there's a train that's bound for glory. No one knows when it will come, but when he does, I will be ready, and I will meet my Lord above. And when I hear that whistle blowing, no longer will I roam. Oh, when that train is bound for glory, it's calling me back home. Well, chapter 25 is kind of like that. It describes the beginning of the eternal story, or if you will, the train to glory. It's how God will take his people to that final city. It's really almost as though he drops a little tiny New Testament right here in the middle of the Old Testament. And it tells us what God has prepared for his people. And so there's two things I want us to see. First, we need a destination. And that is, where are we going and who's on the train? And finally, we have to have a ticket to get there. And I want to give a disclaimer right here. John Bunyan already wrote a whole book on the journey from the city of destruction to the celestial city. You might remember it's called Pilgrim's Progress. I think we studied it one semester, or we might have done it, might have been two. But I just want y'all to know, I felt like it took forever to get there, so we're going to take the express train. Where are we going? Well, we've already seen in chapter 24 what happened to the world city. It's in ruins. It's never going to be rebuilt. So what about the celestial city? Well, chapter 25, 6 through 8 says, on this mountain the Lord Almighty will prepare a feast of rich food for all his peoples, a banquet of aged wine, the best of meats, and the finest of wines. On this mountain he will destroy the shroud that enfolds all peoples, the sheet that covers all nations. He will swallow up death forever. The sovereign Lord will wipe away the tears from all faces, and he'll remove his people's disgrace from all the earth. The Lord has spoken. So the people who arrive singing God's praises are greeted by a feast, just like the elders in Exodus, just like Jesus offered in the miracles when he fed the crowds in Mark chapter 6 and 8. It is a preview of the marriage feast of the Lamb in Revelation 19, and it's for everybody who believes, every tongue and tribe. Alec Motier calls these verses one of the Bible's high spots. Ultimate eternal reality is a banquet with no expense spared, every provision made, every tear dried. He says, this is no pie in the sky. It is confirmed by Jesus and reiterated by John in Revelation. And Motier goes on to say that this is characteristic of our God, to share his heavenly riches with us. It's what salvation is, eternal bounty, the song of those that feast. And Motier ends by saying, and we can be sure of its outcome. So there's not only a feast, but death will be swallowed up forever. And I just think about the feast. I thought about, you know, what's going to be there, and you just start thinking of everything you love, and it's not going to have any calories. It's going to be so nice. You know, you can drink all the sweet tea you want, all the real Coke you want. You know, you can eat dessert first, I'm sure. So anyway, there's not only going to be a feast, but death's going to be swallowed up forever. And that sounds a lot like Revelation 21:4. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Death will be no more. Grieving, crying, and pain will be no more, because the previous things have passed away. All the suffering's gone. Think of all the people you know who suffer. Think of your own suffering. That's all going to be gone. The earthly pilgrimage is over. The burdens will be laid down. All your worst days are gone, and you'll be home. And when it talked about you'll be home, I think about a while back our choir sang an anthem, and the last part of it was, I think it was about shepherding, but it said, There would I find a settled rest while others go and come, no more a stranger nor a guest, but like a child at home. And I thought, there's nothing like, you know, a child roams free at home. They don't worry about anything. There's always somebody there to protect them. Somebody's going to feed them. Somebody's going to care for them. That was, since I'm just a kid at heart, that was a big picture for me, the rest of a child at home. And then it says, the verses say they're going to wipe away the tears. And you know who's going to wipe away the tears? Not your best friend, not the angels. It's going to be the Lord himself. It says he will wipe away every tear. Chapter 26 tells us the city will be strong with salvation for walls and bulwark. A mighty fortress is our God, a bulwark never failing. The gates will be open so that the righteous nation that keeps faith can enter in. And it will be a city of peace because the faithful citizens trust the Lord. They will trust in the Lord forever because he's an everlasting rock. And the city is safe and peaceful because Jesus lives there. I love what Liam Gallagher said. He said, right now, salvation looks like sinners gathered together in the church at worship. But in the new city, it will be full salvation. The journey is over and we'll be there. Church services are over and there's no need for preachers. He said he wasn't real sure what the preachers were going to do all day after that, after they didn't have church services. So sure, the Lord will find something for them. But it is a city planned for us by a loving and a holy God. And you know, actually it already exists because he lives there. Jesus told us he was going to prepare a place for us. So that's the city that God has prepared for us. Now the next question is, who will be on the train with us? Well, first we know they are a singing people. And I just want to tell y'all that if you don't think God is real, you just need to write your lesson and have a little flip about singing, and your small group leader comes with a hymn and makes you sing in your small group today. So I was just like, really, Lord? Is this, you know, are you trying to emphasize that I should have covered that more? But anyway, they are a singing people. The gleanings were singing for joy in chapter 24, even when the world around them was being destroyed. They came into the feast singing in chapter 25. Chapter 26 opens with singing. In that day, this song will be sung in the land of Judah. And finally, we are told to sing about the new vineyard in chapter 27. So if you're in the choir, you're halfway home. But we all need to think about what we have to sing about. To sing to the Lord, even when your life appears to be a disaster, is a powerful message to the unbeliever. And we need to sing his praises for all the joy we have and the mercy he has shown us, and out of gratitude. We learn more about God's people in 25:3-5. It says, therefore, strong peoples will glorify you. Cities of ruthless nations will fear you, for you have been a stronghold to the poor, a stronghold to the needy in his distress, a shelter from the storm, and a shade from the heat. For the breath of the ruthless is like a storm against a wall, like heat in a dry place. Now, I want you to note, it doesn't mention the rich and the famous, the movers and the shakers, the politically powerful, or the social media influencers in those verses. It says it's going to be the poor and the needy. And we may think of that group as a collective, oh, the poor people, the needy people, but in the Hebrew, those nouns for the poor and the needy were singular. They pointed to the Lord's protection for each individual person. So the train is for all the people who've been overwhelmed by storms and trials, the widow and the orphan, those who are victims of injustice, the forgotten, the mistreated by society, lepers and outcasts, as they would say in the New Testament. It's for those who need shelter from the storm and shade from the heat. And after this past summer, we ought to know about needing shade from the heat. These are all people who rely on Jesus and not themselves. They don't have anybody else. And Isaiah 25:9 tells us even more about them. It will be said on that day, behold, this is our God. We have waited for him that he might save us. This is the Lord. We have waited for him. Let us be glad and rejoice in his salvation. So there are people who persevered. They've waited on the Lord. They've been sustained by the goodness of the Lord. In 26:2, it gives us another entrance requirement to get into the city for the people on the train. It says they are right with God and they are faithful. And 26:16 says they've been disciplined by the Lord. So we get a whole picture there of needy people. We get a picture of people who've waiting. It's people really under stress, under trial. And James reminds us of this in the New Testament when he says, consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. Let perseverance finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. We all know people like this, don't we? And the Bible's full of people like this. Think of Hebrews 11, that Hall of Fame chapter for the faithful. But the best verse about these people is in 26:19. Your dead shall live, their bodies shall rise. You who dwell in the dust, awake and sing for joy, for your dew is a dew of light, and the earth will give birth to the dead. One writer says this is the first clear statement of resurrection in the Bible. Motir tells us that the word dew is a dew of light, is linked with the manna of Exodus. So that would have meant a lot to these people in the Old Testament. So the manna literally kept Israel alive. And the dew of light would refer to the light of salvation. Death is darkness and life is light. Isaiah had already told them that the Lord's people are secure in possession of the strong city with its assurance of salvation. So this promise of resurrection would only reinforce that idea for them. The faithful remnant had to trust God on what they couldn't see, while we have the privilege of seeing the promise fulfilled in the resurrection of Jesus. So that was just a flyover of the description provided in chapters 25 and 26 of the people who will be on the train with you. The citizens in the city of salvation are those who are right with God, a relationship that shows in their lifestyle. They sing with joy about the majesty of the Lord. They enjoy his peace because they humbly put their trust in him. And the faithful remnant relies on the Lord for their provision. So chapters 24 to 26 have shown us the future of both the world city and the city of salvation. It's shown us a contrast between the people who live in Babylon and the remnant who will inherit Zion. And at some point, we all have to choose whether to catch the train to glory. And you're like, really, Helen? Who wouldn't choose heaven over Babylon? But it's not that easy, is it? You see, Satan's a sly devil. He makes good seem evil and evil seem good. He tempts us with good things, so we won't want the best things. Think about that old image of Las Vegas, Sin City, the parties, the nightlife, gambling, entertainment. You know, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. All that eye candy is hard to resist, and we have, like, the prosperity gospel that makes you think the Lord should give it all to you, and what suffering is there? It has no answer for suffering. But the devil's going to try to make you think that marching to Zion is boring and no fun. He doesn't want you singing, for sure. It's filled with trials and temptations, rules and commandments that you have to obey. There cannot be any joy in all of that. So you need to think about which city you should choose. Do you believe the devil or do you believe the Lord? You know, and a lot of times I feel like I have one foot in the world and one foot in Zion, and that's not going to work very well. It's like the cartoons when the little people get stretched out and their legs start going because they're on two different trains or they're in two different places. But we can think that we can live in the world and that there's plenty of time to change cities, and that's not really true. And then you need to think about the people who are going to be on the train with you. They're the faithful remnant. Are you living like them? Do you want to live like them? Are you relying on God for your needs? Are you poor and needy? Have you come to a point where God can withdraw his blessings without your trust in him being affected? It doesn't mean you won't be blessed, but you've got to have a humble heart, and you've got to know that God gave you the wealth and the comfort that you might have, and you might not have. You don't know. Are you striving for a Colossians chapter 3 lifestyle, putting to death what is earthly in you, putting on compassionate hearts, kindness, humility, meekness, and patience? Sometimes, you know, it's just not really fun to be that. Are you bearing with one another and forgiving each other? I ask myself these questions because I need to know what city I'm really living in. I don't want to be deceived, and I need to be sure if I'm getting on the right train, and I want to be ready when the bridegroom comes. So once you've decided if you're getting on the train to glory, you're going to need a ticket, aren't you? And so if the Lord's pursued you and you're going to get on that train, how do you get a ticket? Well, everybody knows the answer is Jesus. Thank you, yes. Chapter 27 tells of the redemption of Israel when the train arrives in Mount Zion. It says, in that day, and that's mentioned four times in that chapter. In that day, the Lord with his hard and great and strong sword will punish Leviathan, the fleeing serpent, Leviathan, the twisting serpent, and he will slay the dragon that is in the sea. Leviathan represents the forces of darkness raging against the Lord. They can be natural or supernatural. We know Ephesians 6 tells us that we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, spiritual forces of evil against the heavenly places. But we know the Lord wins. Evil will be destroyed forever. Revelation 12 tells us that the great dragon was thrown down, the ancient serpent, who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. And I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of Christ have come. Because the dragon's destroyed, the vineyard of the Lord that was destroyed way back in Isaiah 5, and we didn't talk a lot about that, but the Lord had a vineyard in that one, and it was Israel. It represented Israel, and it yielded wild grapes because the people were disobedient. But that vineyard is going to be a brand new vineyard. It says, in that day, a pleasant vineyard, sing of it. I, the Lord, am its keeper. Every moment I water it. And we know that Jesus is the true vine, and we only bear fruit if we abide in him. He's going to water, and he's going to protect his vineyard. And it will be fruitful. Verse 6 says that the vineyard will fill the whole world with fruit. The rest of the chapter tells how God restrained evil against his people, and he disciplined them in order to restore them to himself, and that the guilt of Jacob would be atoned for. And finally, Isaiah tells us the Lord will harvest his people. In that day, from the river Euphrates to the brook of Egypt, the Lord will thresh out the grain, and you will be gleaned one by one, O people of Israel. And in that day, a great trumpet will blow, and those who were lost in the land of Assyria and those who were driven out to the land of Egypt will come and worship the Lord on the holy mountain of Jerusalem. The Lord is patiently bringing his harvest home one by one. The blowing of the trumpet signaled the launch of the year of Jubilee, which happened every 50 years in the Old Testament. It was a year-long celebration of rest and homecoming. They relied solely on the Lord. There was no reaping, no sowing, and liberty was proclaimed throughout the land, and certain slaves were set free. We can have this freedom now because Christ paid the price for us. But ultimately, we will have this rest forever when Jesus returns. He will gather his believers on his holy mountain at Jerusalem, and the train to glory will be home, and we will sing his praises forever. This small bit of Isaiah is so rich, you can look at it and if you read through and you say, oh yeah, that reminds me of this passage, and that reminds me of this in the New Testament or the Old Testament. But Isaiah told this to the people long before the exile. So God was preparing them to be out of their own country, not of their own land. So what a message of hope that was for the faithful in Israel. It was dropped in amongst all those oracles of judgment. And what a message of hope for us, that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us and has prepared a place for us to live with him forever. And I want to close with a few verses of Samuel Rutherford's last words. And I confess, I just picked out the ones I liked. It said, "The king there in his beauty without a veil is seen. It were a well-spent journey, though seven deaths lay between. The Lamb with his fair army doth on Mount Zion stand, and glory, glory dwelleth in Emmanuel's land. But that he built a heaven of his surpassing love, a little new Jerusalem like to the one above. Lord, take me o'er the water had been my loud demand. Take me to love's own country, unto Emmanuel's land. I have wrestled on toward heaven, against storm and wind and tide, now like a weary traveler that leaneth on his guide, amid the shades of evening, while sinks life's lingering sand, I hail the glory dawning from Emmanuel's land. With mercy and with judgment, my web of time he wove, and I, the dews of sorrow, were lustered with his love. I'll bless the hand that guided, I'll bless the heart that planned, when throned where glory dwelleth in Emmanuel's land. Oh, I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. He brings a poor vile sinner into his house of wine. I stand upon his merit, I know no other stand, not even where glory dwelleth in Emmanuel's land." Not sure what that is. I hope it's not the trumpet blowing. "The bride eyes not her garment, but her dear bridegroom's face. I will not gaze at glory, but on my King of grace. Not at the crown he giveth, but on his pierced hand. The Lamb is all the glory of Emmanuel's land." Let us pray. Father, we thank you that you give us this great message of hope in the midst of all the trials the people of Israel are experiencing. And we know that's your same message of hope for us today, that we are your people and that what we have is from your hand, but that will all be for the good of those who love you. And we thank you for this message, and we thank you that you have prepared a place for us, and help us to be light for those who still live in the city of destruction. Amen.